The first item on the agenda
is the approval of the minutes of the March 31st meeting. Vice Chair Greenman, would you like to move approval of the minutes for March 31st?
So moved,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Vice Chair Greenman has moved approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. The minutes are approved. The only item on the agenda today is confirmations to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Members may know nominees require a majority vote in committee for a referral to the floor for consideration by the full House. The first candidate is Carol Flynn. So I will move the appointment of Carol Flynn to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board be recommended to be confirmed. Ms. Flynn, if you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee and speak to your background and experience relevant to your appointment, I would appreciate it. So, welcome to the committee. Please just identify yourself first and then proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for appearing on this kind of early spring day, finally. My name is Carol Flynn. I am a retired state senator, and that is the role I fill on the Campaign Finance Board. I have a varied background, ranging from working at the University of Minnesota to being an associate director of AFSCME, the Public Employees Union, state employees, and having worked here at the House even for former Representative Stolgren. So with all of that, as well as having been appointed to the Metropolitan Council, and before that, the Waste Control Commission. So I've had a variety of experiences, many of them relative to what we do on the Campaign Finance Board, that is dealing with candidates and their finances, as well as lobbyists and public officials and their economic interest reports. So those are the kinds of things that we are responsible for in Chapter 10A. I think that about describes who I am. I currently, as I indicated, am retired and live downtown Minneapolis. The campaigns have changed drastically since I served, but the base of the board that we served is to help people meet the requirements of 10A, and that's what we spend our time doing pretty much. We rely on staff to give us their best advice, and then we frequently will debate some of the language or recommendations. It's a small board and a small staff, and it manages to do quite a bit of work statewide.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Members, any discussion? Lee Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this appropriate time to ask a question of the candidate?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Well, welcome to the committee, Ms. Flynn. It's nice to see you. Thank you for your service on the Campaign Finance Board and to the state of Minnesota. It's all appreciated. I'm hoping that as we go through this hearing today, we can talk at some length about the changes that are coming as a result of this year's legislation. Some of it is yet to be signed into law, of course, but it's pretty obvious that that's likely to happen. So just as an opening on this topic, how do you kind of perceive these changes in the areas of electioneering, express advocacy, and foreign influence, and the work the board will need to do in determining how those issues are handled for our election system?
Ms. Flynn, obviously a lot of these changes that are being described haven't become law yet, so I don't expect you to be totally conversant in them at this point, but to the extent you have any comments, please proceed.
Well, actually, the board did take a position in support of Express Advocacy some time back, and it came about because we were observing some what clearly appeared to be election proposals or recommendations based on a picture or a slogan or something, and yet did not meet the magic word requirements and therefore did not show as an independent expenditure. But it did appear that to be consistent again with federal descriptions, it seemed appropriate that we consider that and or recommend it to you as legislators, and clearly it's up to you to decide whether that should be a change in Chapter 10A or not. Our six-person board consists primarily of attorneys who I admit I rely on for the language kinds of issues that come up. Attorneys are really good at arguing and debating about those words. The other former legislator and I tend to spend more time trying to be practical in our decisions and not worry the words quite so much. And therefore, we draw on our own experience. We tend to be very sympathetic to volunteer treasurers. We tend to be most concerned about making sure that the public has adequate information to make judgments on who to vote for and how to vote, when to vote, so on.
Yeah, I should mention for members' benefit too, the presentation that Director Sigurdsson gave to us a month or two ago on Express Advocacy was included in your packets. I believe that was your request, Lead Torkelson. So that's in there and should be on the committee website as well for members of the public. Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer, Ms. Flynn. I appreciate it. So as you probably know then, we're moving from a system of clearly defined guardrails because those words, the trigger words, make it easy to make these determinations, to a situation where it's a much more subjective judgment. Can you talk a little bit about how you think the board will handle making those decisions?
Director Flynn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think it is as subjective as you may think, because it just seemed like any reasonable person would view some of these as clearly campaigning. It just appeared very clear to me at the time. Now I'm sure there will be some times when it may be subjective, and our board has been serious about meeting the requirements of 10A, but also using good judgment, and I'm hoping that that would continue and should not result in any question that normal people, what are normal people, that any reasonable person would arrive at the same conclusion. I should also mention that our board of six people is divided along partisan lines, in that the most issues where there is any disagreement on the board are resolved either because it's a 3-3 vote, and surprisingly, it's usually not along partisan lines. In fact, we just have different of philosophies, perhaps. I tend to hold to the philosophy of openness, of transparency. Others feel more strongly about privacy. And so those are just some of the differences of the persons on the board.
Lee Torkelson?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's your committee, but I'm going to suggest that after we've heard from both candidates that we bring up Mr. Sigurdsson to talk about these issues a bit and his perspective on the changes that are coming the board's way, and then perhaps have further questions for the candidates. I realize I'm stretching things a bit, but I'm just trying to have a good, solid discussion about these changes that are coming for the board and for their work. And as the candidate said, they do rely heavily on staff to progress in their work. I realize I'm maybe over the line, yeah. But this is an important topic,
yeah.
And these are big changes, and it is the campaign finance board that will have jurisdiction and the decision-making power when it comes to answering questions about these topics of electioneering, express advocacy, and foreign influence.
Okay, that'd be fine. I don't have any objection to that. So so maybe we'll just hold off on the vote then until after the vote on the members.
Honestly, Mr. Chair, I'm fine either way with the vote. We can do it right now if you want. It's okay. Really these topics and how the board's work is affected I'm most interested in today.
Sure, that's fine. Representative Quam.
I'm curious from the testifier. The board, I guess, wanted this express, you know, they sort of said, hey, let's have this, we support it. In your experience, since you were in the Senate, if you go back, I think, 4 years ago, there were a couple of races in Rochester where over $1 million was spent independent of the candidates. And were there activities in some of those races that caused the board to say, you know, we really need this change? I'm trying to understand what precipitated and what you've observed that maybe shouldn't have been happening, and that's why the changes made to prevent something from happening.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I know there are some examples in the packet here, too. I don't know if they're from Rochester or not, but Carol Flynn, if you would like to respond.
Those were some of what we observed, yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam.
Okay. Representative Quam?
I wasn't, specifically looking at those examples, but the general thing, spending on, over $1 million being spent on a Senate race is sort of eye-opening, because it's local, and when you figure out how many total people are in the district, voters, that's a lot per vote. But just as a general feeling, what triggered the decision we should change? Because, you've seen this type of the examples around for, I think, quite a while in a general form. I just wanted a better idea of the changes, which helps me to understand the interpretations by the board of wanting this progression, and then understanding how it would improve either civility or et cetera.
Carol Flynn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it is because there is really more independent expenditures occurring. They really, it would appear that these expenditures are really helping or hurting individual candidates. And currently, that is not accounted for. And it did seem appropriate that the public know that there is all this money going in to campaigns, independent expenditures.
All right. Representative Greenland.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Flynn. We got a chance to serve together when I was on the Campaign Finance Board, and I really appreciate your service. And I just want to ask you a few questions about we've been talking a lot about independent expenditures, but you mentioned a key piece of the board is regulating and serving the campaigns that have volunteer treasurers and sort of that whole thing. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, one, if you have ideas or, as you've seen in your experience on the board, ways that the board can help ensure that we can keep a sort of system where folks, many of us, I think, have volunteer treasurers, but can interact with the board in a way that ensures that folks are complying, but that we can continue to have this grassroots campaign infrastructure. If you have any sort of thoughts from your experience on the board.
Senator Flynn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman. Nothing in particular that we have not already suggested to your committee. The lobbyist information we felt was inadequate to really tell the public very much about what lobbyists were spending their time on or their money on or the principals were involved in. And so we had worked with the lobbying organization in order to improve that reporting system. So that is something that you are considering also, besides what we've been discussing. I think, I can't think of anything in addition to that. Where you are moving several different ideas, and we look forward to implementing whatever you end up passing.
Thank you, Senator.
Lee Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you brought, Senator, you brought up the topic of independent expenditures and the growth in independent expenditures. So apparently there's a desire to regulate those somehow. How do you think the board would do that?
Senator Flynn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not so much to regulate, but to identify, I guess, for the public's information. That would be my goal.
Lee Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, well, part of that identification is disclosure. But the Supreme Court has decided that people have a right to be part of an organization and express their opinion without disclosing their identity. There seems to be a conflict there. Any thoughts on how the board might address that particular conflict?
Senator Flynn, I do think the Supreme Court's actually generally upheld the constitutionality of disclosure regimes. I seem to remember Representative Greenman quoting former Justice Scalia in support of the proposition that disclosure is not only constitutional but generally desirable to know who's spending. But Senator Flynn, you were starting to answer.
Indeed, and we indeed recognize that Citizens United is the law too. And so we follow the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Lee Torkelson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to attempt to play one. I think there's a variety of opinions on this, and it's my guess that there will be some further activity by the court as time marches on.
I agree with you on that assessment. So I don't have any additional members on the on the list to talk here. Senator Flynn, did you have any closing remarks or anything before we proceed to a vote?
No, I'm looking forward to your approval and recommendation. I look forward to hearing my colleague, Mr. Rashid, and who I guess I should mention that Representative Greenman served and I served briefly on the board together. So you have someone with experience on your committee.
Yep. Thank you. With that, I will renew the motion that the appointment of Carol Flynn to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board be recommended to be confirmed. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Okay, the motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. The appointment of Carol Flynn to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board is recommended to be confirmed. Next, we have Faris Rashid. I will move that the appointment of Faris Rashid to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board be recommended to be confirmed. Faris Rashid, if you'd like to come down, just please introduce yourself to the committee and speak to your background and experience relevant to your appointment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. My name is Faris Rashid. I'm a partner at Green Espel, which is a law firm in downtown Minneapolis. I was born in Wisconsin. I hope you won't hold that against me, but I've been living in Minnesota since 2010 and have been a lawyer this entire time. I joined the Campaign Finance Board in, I believe it was 2017, primarily because I was looking to do something to give back to the state that has been so welcoming to me. And it has been an incredible opportunity. I very much appreciated my chance to serve on the board. In a lot of ways, among other things, my service on the board makes me proud to be a Minnesotan. The discussions on the board are very collegial, and it is a bipartisan board, so we have honest intellectual discussions about what the right outcome is in a given situation, but I genuinely believe that every member of the board is trying to reach the right decision and approaching the discussion in good faith under the law. So I look forward to every board meeting. I take a lot of pride in the work that we do as a board and stand completely behind the board's staff, including Mr. Siegertson, who do incredible work. And Representative, to your earlier question about treasurers who volunteer for campaigns, I think the staff is really where the magic happens. They hold regular educational sessions and trainings. Anyone who calls the office will always have their questions answered in a very patient and forthright way. If I had a nickel for every time someone thanked the staff for helping them understand the law, I would be a rich person. So I think that's really a service to the state of Minnesota and a credit to the state in how we regulate our campaign finance and public disclosure laws. So thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you, and I'm certainly happy to have any discussion or answer questions.
Thank you, Faris Rashid. Any discussion? Lee Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being with us, Mr. Rashid. Thank you for your service to the Campaign Finance Board. I have to comment on your treasurer remarks because I serve as my own treasurer, so I kind of lead a dual life, and I've had many of my own questions answered by the Campaign Finance Board staff over the years, and you're right, they're very helpful. Just a quick comment before I get to a question. And this is no reflection on you personally, but as I reviewed the members of the board this morning, I noted that they are all from the metropolitan area. You've served as chair of this board. Do you think that has any impact on the work of the board?
Faris Rashid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in a sort of day-to-day sense, respectfully, Representative, I'm not sure. I think, as I said, every member of the board does approach our work in good faith, and at the end of the day, at least for me, I'm looking to the law, I'm looking to the regulations to apply for every decision before us. A lot of our hour-by-hour work in board meetings is reviewing potential or actual violations of campaign finance or disclosure laws, and in doing that, I think we have good open discussions where multiple views are represented. We try our best to sort of understand the position of the treasurer or the representative or whoever it is before the board that's discussing the case. But in general, I think it's a good thing for all elected bodies or appointed bodies to be representative of the populations they represent. I think that serves everyone. I think diversity in general is a good result to work towards, especially when it helps reflect the population that we serve.
Lee Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps we can whisper in the governor's ear when he has a chance to appoint new members to think about some regional diversity on the board. I personally think it's a good idea. Then on to the question that I asked the senator regarding these changes that are coming as a result of either something that's already in law that's obviously about shortly to become law regarding electioneering, express advocacy, foreign influence. Any thoughts on how from your perspective on how the board will handle these changes?
Faris Rashid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, at a sort of 30,000 foot level, I will say generally that it is my view, and I think my fellow members' view, that the goal of the board is not to stifle speech, it's just to understand who is spending the money. So the goal is never to stop someone from campaigning or from taking a position about an election or a ballot issue. The goal is really just to understand where the money is coming from and, as it says in the name, publicly disclose that information. So, for example, with the functional equivalent test, to your earlier questions to Member Flynn, Representative, I do think in some senses it's easier to have sort of a set of magic words that automatically trigger enforcement. But if that was always the case, you wouldn't really need a board and you wouldn't really need to have a deliberative process. I think what we've seen and what I think the country has seen is that there's a lot more money coming into elections than in years past. And again, our goal isn't to stop that money from coming in. It's just to better understand where it's coming from. And the functional equivalent test, you know, applied by reasonable people who have the benefit of debating each other and trying their best to reach the right result, will help better ensure that kind of transparency.
Lee Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then along those lines, how important is it that that drill down to the individual donor that supports the group that may have produced the communication?
Farris Rashid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I confess I don't know exactly the language that is currently in the bill before you all, but my understanding is that if it's, for example, a corporation that is paying for speech, that the corporation will be disclosed, but not necessarily every single dollar that that corporation collected from someone else. But in general, my personal view, again, is that if you are spending money on an election, if you're taking a position, that you should stand behind your word, and it's generally a good thing to err on the side of transparency.
Lee Torkelson?
I'm going to leave it at that, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, if it's at all possible after we finish this confirmation to bring Mr. Sigurdsson
sure.
up to talk about these issues, I think that would be enlightening.
Sure, that'd be fine. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rashid. I will tell you full disclosure up front. I'm a 20-year veteran of the technology industry. I am specifically an Agile Scrum Master and coach, which approaches a very people-centered design in all things online, and a firm believer that we should be using technology to better serve our people, to better focus on that, and particularly when it comes to government. And I'm just curious, because I noticed that you have a background in a number of areas pertaining to technology, and this is maybe just a more open-ended question, but I'm curious, because of that background, how you see that informing potential future recommendations from the Campaign Finance Board about how we can make sure that the Campaign Finance Board is not only transparent, but that it's really serving the public interest. And using technology or improving our technology solutions within campaign finance to do that.
Farris Rashid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. And to kind of dovetail with what I was saying a moment ago about erring on the side of transparency, I think technology has the potential to be hugely transformative in many respects, you know, across society, but certainly in this one. It's as I have become more familiar with the work that the board does and the staff does, we collect a lot of information from many different parts of the electoral process. And the staff of the board works very, very hard to report that information out to ensure its accuracy. But you could see with a couple of leaps of imagination and maybe a couple of budgetary leaps to go with the leaps of imagination, ways in which information could be made radically transparent and very user-friendly, where if you went to a website, you could look up spending that's happening, activity that's happening, what the board is doing. There are a lot of ways where information, I think we're reaching a point, I'm going to go on a huge digression if I don't stop myself, but we're reaching a point in society where we sit on a lot of information, but we haven't yet done a great job of helping people see and understand that information. And I think that's true for campaign finance laws as well. And also just in a more practical way, a lot of reporting now is done online. And again, the staff has gone to great lengths to make it as user-friendly as possible. But again, with some more imagination or maybe just more support, that can be made even more user-friendly to the point where if you're a volunteer treasurer, for example, it's very easy to do what you're supposed to do in terms of reporting and not have to worry about, you know, missing a deadline or something like that. So there are lots of ways in which I think technology can be very useful.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rashid. I really appreciate that, and I do know that I am often very interested in how we can use technology to better improve processes and procedures and transparency within the campaign finance board system, and I would look forward to recommendations in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the lines of the previous discussion, how would you interpret the board's, now that we have express advocacy and some tweaks, the algorithms utilized in social media can bias and filter the information so that they're actually helping or advocating for certain issues and with the candidates. So how are you going to take an issue like that? Let me understand your thought process on that.
Ferris Rashid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I'm tracking the question, and maybe a larger sort of thought is appropriate in response, which is I think the power of social media and the ability to sort of very carefully target people with advertisements is a power that we've only recently begun to understand as a society, and certainly will only become much more complicated with things like ChatGPT, where you can create, you know, maybe ad copy or campaign copy with the press of a button, custom designed for someone online. These kinds of issues are cutting edge, and they will have profound implications, I think, for campaigning for campaign laws. And we've not even yet begun to fully understand how to address some of the challenges presented. But again, I do think transparency is our ally in this kind of, in the future that we face together. In understanding who is spending for these sort of targeted campaign buys, or understanding how ad copy is being generated, those are things that can only help us better make decisions instead of just being manipulated by algorithms online. So again, to the extent that there is something pending in the legislation before you all in favor of transparency in this kind of arena, I support it. And I expect that in the next, you know, 5 years or less, we will be back talking about these kinds of issues and maybe thinking about other ways we can better address the kinds of spending and algorithm manipulation that are happening behind the scenes.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. That the advertising and that is only part of it. The actual thing about the filtering and biasing is when a social media or a online entity actually squashes one side and promotes another side. That's an inherent bias. And if you're getting into advocating for, that is actually a way of advocating for one candidate or another by hiding posts in social media that are bringing out certain points and information, and then having first up envision things supporting the other. So how do you see the board looking at that kind of influence and meddling in campaigns?
Ferris Rashid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I understand better now, thank you, the sort of the point or the question that you're getting at. And candidly, I'm not sure that these kinds of questions might be above my pay grade and the board's pay grade, so to speak. We're not actually paid. But the we get a per diem. But the questions of, for example, if I can just put a name out there, of like a Facebook of the world or a social media platform of the world that might have a bias in one direction or another, or even just a perceived bias. Those are important questions. Those are questions that are on the top of, I think, many people's minds in America. But they're also questions that I think are best addressed at the federal and state legislature levels. And I don't know that as I sit here today, there is a law that I can point to in the Minnesota statutes that allows us to better tackle these kinds of questions. If Facebook itself was paying for advertising, that would be one thing. But your question is about a much more sort of subtle dynamic. And I look forward to hearing ideas that this body or the federal government come forward with in terms of understanding that kind of manipulation of campaigning or suppression of campaigning and speech, and how better to tackle those kinds of issues, because they are real.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then since you were chair of the board around the time that the board was promoting, some of the language that in the bills, how do you see being able to differentiate between the board intent and the legislative intent?
Paris Rashid?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're all human, we're all doing our best, but my goal is to enact legislative intent and what case law has said in interpreting what the law says. That is what I do every day as a lawyer, and that is what I try to do on the board. We do kind of wear dual hats on the board in some respects, because we do try to take a longer view. We try to look for technical changes or things like the functional equivalent test that will help bring transparency or better understanding to the public. But in the sort of bread and butter of what the board does, where we're looking at applying the law to a particular situation or applying regulations to a particular situation, in that context, I think the board intent should be subsumed to legislative intent, and then after that, to what the statutes say, and then what legislative intent was, and then what courts have said in interpreting that language. That, to me, is the whole ballgame. My personal intent shouldn't matter in that situation. Obviously, again, I'm human, and I bring my own experiences and biases, to bear, consciously or unconsciously, but my goal is not to exercise board intent or to achieve a particular result in a situation. It's just to apply the facts as they exist to apply the law as it exists to the facts of that particular situation. And we do that all the time, and the facts can vary very widely, and that changes how we decide.
Representative Kwong?
Thank you. And on to the foreign influence and some of the legislative activity to include non-citizens participating in the endorsement and party activities. How does the board look at in-kind contributions? Because especially in some of the more contested races, there are people that may be paid $15 an hour to do certain campaign activities. If somebody does in-kind contribution, as in providing transport, participating in these same activities that others are being paid for, but they aren't a citizen, what's the interpretation on the foreign influence of in-kind and activity in a campaign?
Faris Rashid?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I again would err on the side of transparency. I think it is for the public good to better understand if there are foreign people or corporations contributing to an election, be it through money or in-kind contributions. I think the public has a right to know that, and the public has a right to factor that into how they think about a particular advertisement or a particular campaign. I don't know, again, I apologize, I don't know exactly what the language is right now as it's sort of percolating through the process in terms of foreign contributions, but generally speaking, I personally am in support of more transparency when it comes to foreign contributions.
Representative Kwong?
That's all now.
Okay, thank you. All right. I don't see any additional member questions. Would you have any closing remarks, Faris Rashid?
No, just thank you very much, representatives, for your time and attention. I very much appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. So with that, I will renew the motion that the appointment of Faris Rashid to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board be recommended to be confirmed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Congratulations.
You.
The appointment of Faris Rashid to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board is recommended to be confirmed. So, Lead Torkelson has asked for a little additional discussion on some of the issues related to express advocacy, and we have Director Sigurdsson here, who's, do you have sufficient guidance, Director Sigurdsson, about what you're going to
what you've been asked to discuss here, or just, I guess, if you could just identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Jeff Sigurdson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I don't really have a prepared statement, sir, but I understand that there are some questions based on what I've heard before, and I'd be glad to try to respond to any specific questions that members may have.
Okay, sure. I guess maybe I'll turn it over to you then, Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you guide the board as your role as staff, and let's just start out with this issue of express advocacy. Your presentation earlier this year, we saw some pieces that seem to be right on the borderline, so to speak. Any further thoughts on how the board will do its work now that this is either law or about to become law?
Director Sigurdson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson. The issue, I believe the board brought this forward because the examples, that at least that they were looking at, they're included in the PowerPoint. And I recognize that this was not provided in the committee materials, so the example I have up on the screen you may not find appropriate to look at now. But frankly, they were not on the gray area. I don't think there is any other reasonable interpretation that this was an effort by particular associations to influence voting, and who are very aware of the express advocacy standard and the limitations then that that placed on the board to be able to request disclosure on the funding and the amount of expenditures made. Remember that the 40-some million dollars that we saw in independent expenditures committee, independent expenditures reported to the board, doesn't include anything that you see in that PowerPoint, or doesn't include the one example I would like to bring up. But the board, in two different investigations in 2021, said, you know what, this is not express advocacy. We are not going to extend artificially our authority to cover these associations, because they very well understand the express advocacy, standard. And under functional equivalent, it would have been covered, but it's not. That's not the standard we have before us, and so we're walking away from it. I think generally, the examples that the board have before it, I guess I would be interested in hearing any explanation other than they were trying to influence voting. I think that the ones that the board that would look at and the standard expected through U.S. Supreme Court decisions looking at the functional equivalent standard says that it has to be have no other reasonable interpretation, which is a way of saying that I believe that as applied, the board is going to have to be very sure of itself that, in fact, that this communication was to influence elections. If there is a reasonable doubt, then it's no longer within the purview of the board to view that as a reasonable, no other reasonable interpretation, and it wouldn't be viewed as functional equivalent. I think, again, that's the strength of a board with three members from one party and three members from the other. I think there'd have to be four individuals who believe there's nothing other than a reasonable interpretation that it was trying to influence elections. And I guess I would leave it at that, sir, for your follow-up.
Lead Torkelson?
Then let's talk a little bit about electioneering, if you don't mind, and the changes there.
Director Sigurdson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the electioneering communication is a little bit different standard, because it's acknowledging that there are communications that could be reasonably interpreted, again using that reasonable interpretation standard, as for a purpose other than to influence elections, frankly lobbying. A communication that says contact the governor and let them know that he's not spending nearly enough to keep our highways safe and to increase highway funding, that's lobbying. And so it wouldn't fall under the definition of electioneering communication unless it falls within a certain timeline, which is shortly before the primary election or 60 days before the general election. I believe I have that correct. Plus, under the current version, that apparently is going to go through. It has to be an electronic communication, and it has to be over $10,000. But putting those aside as as qualifiers. The question is whether or not it can be reasonably interpreted as trying to influence official action. If it is, then it's not going to be campaign literature. It's going to be electioneering communication, and will only require reporting of the cost of that expenditure and the funding for that expenditure if it falls within those tight guidelines of dates prior before the primary and general election. So there is an acknowledgement that there is communications that could be interpreted reasonably as for something other than trying to influence in the election. And the only reason that they are brought under the board's jurisdiction is because they're close proximity to the election.
Lead Torkelson?
Well, thank you. And that, of course, begs the question of the arbitrariness of establishing those timelines. I realize that has been our job, I guess, or across the aisle's job, but it seems unusual that we have a cutoff date, so to speak, and how that cutoff date is established it suddenly transforms a communication from one form to another seems rather arbitrary.
Any comment, Director Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it is arbitrary, but it probably goes to your other comment on express advocacy. It might be arbitrary, but at least it's a clear line in the sand. When you have a communication that can be reasonably interpreted on both sides, is it going to be for influencing election, or is it trying to influence public policy? Is it educational, in other words? If the communication can be used for both, then you want a clear line in the sand. And while I acknowledge the arbitrary nature of any date, it is at least a clean line in the sand saying, on this side, it's not reportable. On this side, it is. And that's my understanding of why there's a specific date set.
Lead Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then finally, on the issue of foreign influence and the percentages, and who's going to make these determinations on whether these corporations are foreign influenced by the definition or not?
Director Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the board's role here, I think, is a little bit more limited than that. Frankly, we collect documentation from any corporation that makes a contribution to an independent expenditure committee, and that certification provided by the corporation says that we are not a foreign influence corporation, or the 1% or 5%. The board would not have the resources to then say, well, I'm sorry, X corporation, open up your books and we need to look at everybody that owns stock. I suppose it's possible that someone may file a complaint saying that that's a false statement, but in most cases, I would say going into it without any actual knowledge of how to, of prior administration of the statute, I think it's going to be very unlikely because of, frankly, the severe penalties that corporations, CEOs of corporations face if they sign a certification saying they're not foreign influenced and in fact they were. It's criminal. There are large fines, and if it's a knowing violation, it's actually a criminal violation. So my expectation, and this is a new provision, the board has no experience with this particular statute, is that the CEOs of corporations are going to be very careful in signing a certificate saying that they are not foreign influenced because they are personally liable. Not the corporation, but they are personally liable. So the board's role here is to collect those certifications every time a contribution is made by a corporation and to provide that to the public to show that the corporation has acknowledged or stated that they are not foreign influenced.
I believe Representative Greenman might have. Was that to this issue?
No, I just have a question.
Oh, okay. All right. Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to ask Mr. Sigurdsson about the free speech issues here because I think it's beyond his purview, but it does bring up some serious challenges. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just looking at this. I think this is this handout from you all, but this chart about independent expenditures by party unit, political committee, independent expenditure committees, but mostly just the thing that is most striking is how the chart sort of exponentially goes up, right? And so when we talk about some of the things that I heard some of the board members say before, one of the reasons that the board has gotten behind supporting an express advocacy standard, the functional equivalent standard, is because of the increase in independent expenditures and independent spending, since I presume Citizens United is sort of the change agent. I'm wondering if you can talk about how this chart, like what this does and does not contain, what independent spending would not be on this chart, given our current rules, if that makes sense. Like, how is this giving us a full picture that Minnesotans want of who's spending money to try to influence their elections?
Director Sigurdson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, I believe that it does, in fact, reflect the majority of independent expenditures made within the state. I still think it does. I think the vast majority of independent expenditures is still being made through committees and funds registered with the board, who then turn around and report the numbers that that chart is based on. But again, in 2021, the board looked at two investigations where it was clear that not all expenditures to influence elections were being captured by the express advocacy standard, and that in fact that number, that chart, would be even higher if they were included. That raised the concern from the board's perspective that, okay, one, we're not providing a full picture to the public. Two, reporting is an obligation, and if it becomes apparent to independent expenditure committees and funds who are currently reporting to the board that a minor shift in wording would allow them to disengage from that reporting requirement, it might be a scenario where we would see less disclosure, less reporting, closing down of some committees because it's fairly easy to walk around the express advocacy standard. And then the third issue, which might be more technical, but it is that you have two standards. You have a standard at the federal level, which would require disclosure of functional equivalent advertisements in the state of Minnesota, and then you have the exact same advertisement, basically in terms of content, for a state level office, but does not have to be disclosed. From the public's perspective, and frankly from my perspective, that's a little confusing and contradictory that, okay, this is an independent expenditure, even though it doesn't say vote for a federal candidate, and yet this one for the state candidate is not. A consistent standard for candidates within the state, whether they be federal or state level, is another advantage. I don't have the ability to tell you what I don't know, which is to say I don't know the amount of expenditures made that were functional equivalent rather than express advocacy. But again, in two investigations in 2021, they were clearly happening, and were happening in Facebook, were happening in handouts and mailings, in newspaper ads. It was websites that were coming right up to the line. I would say that I understand there's always the concern that someone may unintentionally fall across that line and not realizing that, and that's fine. The board would consider the knowledge of the individual if a violation occurred. But the repeated nature of advertisements that go right up to the line, don't use express advocacy, indicates that there are many associations who are sophisticated actors and who are very much aware of the standard and who are using that standard then as a basis of not reporting to the board.
Thank you. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Director Sigurdson, and that's really helpful. Can you give explain from the voter's perspective, from a member of the public's perspective, the difference in terms of what they're seeing, whether it's a disclaimer, whether it's reporting on your website, but the difference between it being this electoral spending being in the express advocacy and functional equivalent standard or not falling within that, if that makes sense. Like, sort of how would a voter experience these advertisements differently?
Director Sigurdson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, if I understand your question, I would think a voter wouldn't see a difference between the two. For the functional equivalent, again, we're looking at the reasonable standard. With the chair's permission, can I show one example? It's not within your packet. I don't know if that's appropriate, but it kind of goes to Representative Greenman's question.
Sure.
We're sort of off schedule here, I know, but this is from an investigation in 2021, and assuming I can get it to roll, Kate.
I hope there's a visual example. That's a lot of text.
There is. I won't read it to you. At the end, sorry.
and that may be too small to see. But basically, the Facebook ad says, names the candidate or names the individual.
Eric, if you could maybe speak into the, well, I don't know if you are able to read it and speak into the microphone at the same time.
It says, I have to remind myself what it says. It names the individual, candidate for state representative, pledges to not raise your taxes. Again, the board found that this was not express advocacy because it doesn't say vote for this person. But under what reasonable standard would this association put out a whole bunch of Facebook advertisements that say basically the same thing just prior to the election, unless they were trying to influence your vote? If I'm a voter, from my perspective, I think it's fair to say that I would expect there to be the ability to be able to see who paid for this or what the association was that is putting out these advertisements. And under current statute, the answer is there is no ability to do so. So it seemed, I mean, the complaint was based on the fact I went to your website and I can't find this association. So that's I think there is no reason for the average voter to look at something like that and understand why disclosure is not required, if that was your question.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Secretan. And I think that's what I was getting at, is the difference between being having to disclose, having a disclaimer, having that information on the website. That is the difference for a voter. Right, they may not be able to tell the difference between these ads, but they, one ad will be required to have a disclaimer that says who it's paid for, by an address where you can find that, and information on the board. And I guess that's what I was getting at and sort of asking of the information that voters would have for the ads that fit within this definition that the board requires reporting for.
Representative
Quam. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And earlier in the discussion, you said above this limit. What sort of analysis of coordinated aggregate to reach a limit? In other words, we can't spend over this amount or we cross the line for notification, but you've got three that will spend half of what that limit is, and the message is a normal person would notice that that was a coordinated effort. Do you ever look at the impacts of the aggregate across several players?
Director Secretan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, the registration requirement for an independent expenditure committee, in other words, committees that are making expenditures without coordination with the candidate, is $1,500, so a relatively low threshold. If there was an allegation, a complaint that came to us saying that, well, these three groups are working together and they've each agreed not to spend over $1,000, and assuming that there was some evidence to that effect, the board would investigate, because that sort of coordination would be a way of circumventing the requirement of the statute. And so would be an issue that the board would look at if that was the problem. Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, could I also address one question I believe you had for the last board member that maybe I could add a little bit more to, if that's...
Sure.
I believe one of your questions was the concern about individuals being disclosed for contributing to an association that makes an advertisement that it's now functional equivalent. I would point out that the disclosure required for an independent expenditure committee that either forms its own independent expenditure, an association that forms its own independent expenditure fund, or that makes a contribution to an existing independent expenditure fund or a committee, the disclosure is much different than the disclosure that comes through a candidates committee. In no case would an individual be disclosed if they didn't contribute over $5,000. So the $5,000 standard, as opposed to the $200 standard, I think is put in there deliberately
to protect small donors to associations that are going to be very surprised that their funds are somehow being disclosed as a contribution when they didn't realize that they were making a contribution to what they thought was an educational organization, and now they're being listed as being the source of funding for an independent expenditure. So it's $5,000, which certainly removes many smaller contributors. And two, without going into the kind of the elaborate way of in which disclosure occurs for independent expenditure committees, they have the right to allocate their contributions in a way that no more than the first $5,000 is used. So, for example, a large organization that may have 20,000 contributors, even if some of those contributors were over $5,000, if they can show enough funds to cover the cost of the independent expenditure, they can go up to $4,999 of a contributor who gave over $5,000, allocate that to what's disclosed, and there are still going to be very limited disclosure of individuals. We being the board, receives disclosure on the source of funding for independent expenditures through funds and associations that don't create their own independent expenditure fund. But frankly, individuals, drilling down to the individuals, rarely occurs. We understand the association, but there is rarely going to be a case where a small contributor, in fact, I would say never a case unless you want to say people over $5,000 are a small contributor. Small contributors are simply never disclosed and are not subject to any possible, I guess, consequences as being identified with an independent expenditure effort.
Thank you. I don't have any additional members on the list, so thank you for your testimony and the interesting discussion, Director Sigurdsson. This is the last scheduled committee hearing. I mean, I guess it's always possible we can come back, but I don't expect us to. So just want to thank committee members, both sides of the aisle, for an engaging committee. It's been a pleasure and honor to serve with all of you. Of course, our staff, we would be nowhere without all of you. So Helen Roberts from House Fiscal, Matt Gehring from House Research, our page Chris Ohlendorf, Lori Cousineau from GOP Research, John Beeler from DFL Research, our CLA Mike Hermanson, and our committee administrator Simon Brown. So you make this all look a lot smoother than and make me a lot look better than I think I would otherwise. So thank you for all of your work, and thank you, Lee Torkelson, for a good committee. And I guess with that, I will adjourn the committee.